Should Alberta Leave Canada? By Elias Trent. Read by Barclay Cavill. Foreword by Darren Grimes. I've spent the better part of a decade writing, arguing, and organizing around Indigenous rights in Canada. I have criticized Ottawa's paternalism. I've documented federal failure in treaty implementation, social policy, and economic development. I have argued consistently that centralized power too often substitutes moral language for measurable results. So let me be direct. It is remarkable that a federal government with a century and a half of broken promises, administrative overreach, and chronic underperformance is treated as the unquestioned default custodian of justice, while structural alternatives are dismissed before they are even examined. That reflex deserves scrutiny. This book does not romanticize provincial governments. It does not pretend Alberta or Saskatchewan are innocent actors in history, nor does it deny the constitutional primacy of treaty rights. What it does is ask a more uncomfortable question. Why is decentralization automatically framed as danger, while centralization, despite its record, is framed as stability? Indigenous nations sign treaties with the Crown, not with a modern bureaucratic apparatus headquartered in Ottawa and operationalized through layers of administrative insulation. The Crown's obligations were supposed to be relational, accountable, and rooted in mutual recognition. Instead, much of that relationship has been filtered through distant ministries and federal agencies that operate with limited local accountability. If skepticism exists toward new constitutional arrangements, it is understandable. History justifies caution, but history also justifies skepticism toward centralized authority that has repeatedly failed to deliver on its own commitments. The Prairie debate forces a confrontation with structural reality. Alberta and Saskatchewan contribute materially to the national economy through resource development. They operate under a federal structure in which fiscal redistribution, regulatory authority, and institutional power are concentrated elsewhere. Their grievances are not imaginary. They are embedded in representation formulas and Senate allocation and national energy policy shaped by electoral arithmetic concentrated outside the West. None of that invalidates treaty rights. None of that erases federal responsibilities. But it does raise a legitimate question. Is the existing structure the only morally permissible arrangement? When serious proposals for pension autonomy, revenue at source taxation, or institutional decentralization are dismissed as inherently destabilizing, we should ask why institutional change is more frightening than institutional stagnation. Centralization has a track record. It is not a theoretical good. It has produced measurable failures in Indigenous policy, measurable economic distortions in resource governance, and measurable regional alienation. This book approaches the Prairie question without slogans. It models independence scenarios soberly. It dissects fiscal transfers. It evaluates U.S. statehood with a constitutional realism. It analyzes Senate reform and the mathematics of coalition building. It treats Indigenous sovereignty as a constitutional fact, not rhetorical garnish. But it refuses to accept the premise that questioning Ottawa's structural dominance is inherently radical. In any federation, legitimacy flows from adaptability. If institutions cannot evolve, pressure accumulates. If grievances cannot be addressed through reform, they migrate toward rupture. The Prairie question is not a rejection of Canada, it is a stress test. And if Canada's federal structure cannot withstand disciplined scrutiny, if it requires intellectual gatekeeping rather than argument to preserve itself, then the problem is not regional dissatisfaction, the problem is structural fragility. Decentralization is not extremism, it is a principle embedded in federalism itself. If we believe treaties were nation-to-nation agreements, then we should not be afraid of conversations about restructuring power. If we believe accountability matters, then we should not instinctively defend distance. This book does not demand separation, it demands seriousness. And seriousness begins by acknowledging that centralized authority in Canada has not earned automatic deference. Part 1. Origins of Structure. Chapter 1. Sovereignty Before Confederation. Before Confederation extended Canadian jurisdiction across the Northern Plains, the territory that would become Alberta and Saskatchewan was governed through systems that were politically organized, legally structured, and economically coordinated. These systems did not resemble European parliamentary states, nor were they centralized bureaucracies. Yet they exercised authority over territory, mediated disputes, regulated economic life, and conducted diplomacy. To describe the Prairie West prior to 1870 as politically unformed is to misunderstand both the institutional depth of Indigenous nations and the complexity of the order that existed before Canadian expansion. Across the plains and parkland regions lived Cree, Blackfoot, Siksikatsatapi, Assiniboine, Salto, Nakota, and Dene peoples, among others. Each nation possessed its own political culture and territorial orientation. Yet common features marked governance across the region. Authority was relational rather than purely coercive. Leaders were selected through a combination of lineage, demonstrated competence, generosity, and the ability to build consensus. Chiefs did not rule by decree, they persuaded. Influence depended on reputation, kinship, networks, and capacity to redistribute resources in times of scarcity. Political organization was layered. At the band level, decision-making involved councils composed of respected leaders, accomplished hunters, spiritual leaders, and recognized warriors. Matters of migration, alliance, and conflict were debated collectively. Broader confederacies, such as the Blackfoot Confederacy, linked multiple bands through diplomatic and military coordination. The Confederacy was not a centralized state, but a structured alliance, capable of collective decision-making in response to external threats or opportunities. Law existed not as codified statute books, but as enforceable norms. Social expectations regulated marriage alliances, hunting territories, compensation for injury, and obligations during trade. Enforcement mechanisms included restitution, public censure, exclusion from communal activities, or in severe cases, expulsion. Because survival on the plains required cooperation, law was embedded in reciprocity. Social sanction carried weight precisely because mobility did not eliminate interdependence. Exclusion could mean isolation in an unforgiving environment. Territory on the plains was not surveyed into rectangular parcels, but it was neither undefined nor anarchic. Hunting grounds were recognized, defended, and negotiated. Overlapping use rights were common, particularly in transitional ecological zones. Diplomacy managed these overlaps. Treaties between Indigenous nations long predated European arrival. Peace pacts, marriage alliances, and ceremonial exchanges formalized relationships. These diplomatic traditions would later influence treaty negotiations with the Crown, though the two sides operated with different assumptions about sovereignty and land transfer. Economic coordination was central to governance. The bison hunt illustrates how political authority functioned in practice. Large-scale hunts required timing, discipline, and shared rules to prevent premature action that could scatter herds and jeopardize food supply. Among the Métis communities of the Red River and Saskatchewan River regions, the hunt operated under a written code. Captains were elected, scouts determined herd location, penalties were imposed on those who disobeyed collective strategy. This was governance adapted to mobility, formal enough to enforce order, flexible enough to respond to shifting ecological conditions. A scene from a late summer hunt on the plains captures this institutional reality. The camp stretches along a riverbank, hundreds of carts arranged in a defensive circle, smoke rising from cooking fires. At the center, the council convenes. A respected elder speaks first, urging patience until scouts confirm herd movement. A younger hunter, eager and confident, argues for immediate pursuit. The captain listens, then turns to others. After debate, consensus forms. They will wait. A rider who later attempts to break formation and charge ahead is brought before the council. He is fined and publicly admonished. The authority exercised is not theatrical, it is practical. Collective survival depends on discipline. Such scenes reveal a political order in which governance, economy, and law were inseparable. Decision-making was neither autocratic nor chaotic. It was embedded in shared norms reinforced by communal necessity. European arrival altered but did not immediately displace this order. The fur trade introduced new goods, new alliances, and new rivalries. Yet indigenous nations retained control over production and territory. They determined who could trade, under what conditions, and where posts could be established. The Hudson's Bay Company and its competitors depended on indigenous trappers and intermediaries. Economic leverage translated into diplomatic influence. Indigenous leaders negotiated trade relationships, strategically balancing access to firearms and metal goods against risks of dependency. Political systems adapted. Some leaders gained influence through their ability to secure advantageous trade terms. Others navigated shifting alliances as American traders pushed northward and inter-tribal competition intensified. Epidemics introduced by Europeans disrupted demographic stability, altering power balances among nations. Yet governance structures persisted, adjusting to new realities without dissolving into disorder. From the standpoint of European imperial law, Rupert's Land was granted to the Hudson's Bay Company in 1670. But this charter did not erase indigenous sovereignty on the ground. Company officials lacked the capacity to impose comprehensive rule across vast territories. Their authority rested on trade monopolies and localized jurisdiction at posts. Beyond those posts, indigenous law prevailed. This layered sovereignty complicates later narratives of annexation or transfer. When Britain authorized the transfer of Rupert's Land to Canada in 1868-70, it treated sovereignty as an imperial asset capable of conveyance. Yet, on the plains, sovereignty remained lived and practiced by indigenous nations. The absence of consultation and transfer negotiations reflected imperial legal assumptions, not the disappearance of indigenous political reality. Comparative examples underscore this distinction. In the United States, westward expansion involved treaties, military conquest, and the establishment of territorial governments anticipating eventual statehood. The doctrine of manifest destiny framed expansion as inevitable. Yet, even there, indigenous nations were treated as treaty partners, albeit within a coercive framework, until federal authority consolidated control. In Australia, British settlement proceeded under the legal fiction of terras nullius, denying indigenous sovereignty altogether. Canada's prairie expansion occupied an intermediate position. It did not deny indigenous presence, but it subsumed indigenous governance within Crown sovereignty through treaties negotiated after transfer rather than before. The political psychology embedded in these processes would have long-term implications. For indigenous nations, treaties were understood as agreements to share land and establish coexistence, not wholesale surrender of sovereignty. For Canadian authorities, treaties functioned as instruments of land cession, facilitating settlement. This divergence in interpretation reflected fundamentally different conceptions of authority and ownership. The Prairie West, before Confederation, was thus not a vacuum awaiting national organization. It was a mosaic of self-governing societies operating within ecological constraints and economic frameworks. Authority flowed through kinship, consensus, and reciprocity rather than centralized statute. Law existed in enforceable norms. Diplomacy regulated territorial boundaries. Economic coordination reinforced political legitimacy. Recognizing this complexity does not require romanticizing indigenous governance. Intertribal warfare occurred. Power struggles unfolded within bands and confederacies. Social hierarchies existed. Nor does it negate the transformative impact of Confederation, railways, and agricultural settlement. Rather, it situates Canadian expansion within an already structured political landscape. Whether the prairies were annexed, negotiated into Confederation, or absorbed depends partly on this starting point. If one assumes the land lacked organized sovereignty, transfers appear administrative. If one acknowledges pre-existing political orders, transfer appears as a reallocation of authority layered atop functioning systems. Long-term implications flow from this recognition. Contemporary debates about resource control, treaty rights, and provincial autonomy cannot be disentangled from the original layering of sovereignties. Indigenous nations did not vanish upon Confederation. They were incorporated into a constitutional framework that both recognized and constrained their authority. The federal government assumed jurisdiction over Indians and lands reserved for Indians, centralized responsibility while limiting Indigenous self-determination. For Alberta and Saskatchewan, the pre-Confederation order complicates narratives of simple absorption. The provinces did not inherit empty territory. They inherited land shaped by treaties and Indigenous jurisdiction. Any contemporary argument about decentralization or sovereignty must grapple with this foundational reality. Indigenous governance on the plains was neither incidental nor symbolic. It was the first political order of the region, one that structured land use, economic coordination, and diplomacy long before Ottawa asserted authority. Understanding that order provides necessary context for evaluating how the Prairie West entered Confederation and how its layered sovereignties continued to shape political life. When British imperial authority first formalized its claim over the vast interior of northern North America, it did so not by dispatching regiments or establishing settler assemblies, but by granting monopoly to a corporation. The Hudson's Bay Company, chartered in 1670 by King Charles II, was endowed with sweeping rights over Rupert's Land, the immense territory defined by the watershed draining into Hudson's Bay. The charter granted the company exclusive trading privileges, rights to establish forts and factories, authority to make ordinances, and power to administer justice among its employees and within its posts. In legal theory, this was proprietary sovereignty. In practice, it was a hybrid arrangement that combined commercial ambition with quasi-governmental authority. The Royal Charter represented a distinctly early modern conception of empire. Rather than direct rule, the Crown delegated territorial administration to chartered companies capable of financing exploration and trade. The Company of Adventurers of England, trading into Hudson's Bay, as it was formerly known, operated under the logic that commerce would precede and justify governance. The territory was not conceived as a future province or dominion, but as a resource basin whose value lay in fur exports. Authority flowed from London through a governor and committee to factors and traders stationed at remote posts along river systems and coastal inlets. The language of the charter is striking in its breadth. It empowered the company to make, ordain, and establish laws and ordinances for the governance of Rupert's Land, provided they were not contrary to the laws of England. It granted rights to levy reasonable fines and impose punishment. It allowed the company to seize ships trading illegally in the region. On paper, this resembled sovereignty, yet the company's authority was both expansive and limited. It was expansive in that it monopolized trade and claimed jurisdiction over vast geography. It was limited in that it lacked demographic control and military dominance over Indigenous nations who occupied the land. Corporate governance in Rupert's Land differed significantly from colonial models in Upper and Lower Canada. There was no elected assembly. There were no representative institutions accountable to settlers. Decision-making remained concentrated among company officers and London directors. The governance logic was commercial rather than civic. Profitability structured administrative decisions. Posts were opened or closed according to trade viability. Alliances were maintained to secure fur supply. Justice at trading posts addressed disputes among employees, breaches of contract, or violent incidents affecting trade stability. A scene at York Factory in the early 19th century illustrates this order. In a timber-framed hall overlooking the cold waters of Hudson Bay, the chief factor presides over a dispute between two company servants accused of diverting trade goods for personal exchange. The factor references company ordinances, admonishes the accused, and imposes a fine deducted from wages. The authority is formal but corporate. There's no jury of settlers, no municipal council. The legitimacy of the ruling derives from the company charter and the hierarchical employment structure. Outside the palisade walls, Indigenous traders await negotiated exchange. The factor's authority extends clearly within the post. Beyond it, negotiation replaces command. Trade authority was the core of company sovereignty. The fur trade depended on indigenous trappers and middlemen. The company did not farm or mine. It bartered manufactured goods for pelts. Economic leverage therefore shaped governance style. Company officials cultivated diplomatic relationships with Cree, Assiniboine, and Dene leaders. Gifts, credit systems, and seasonal advances reinforced alliances. The company's interest lay in maintaining peace along trade corridors. Intertribal warfare disrupted supply lines. Thus, company policy often encouraged mediation rather than confrontation. This arrangement complicates later narratives of absolute imperial control. Unlike settler colonies in Australia, where British legal doctrine of terra nullius denied indigenous sovereignty outright, Rupert's Land operated through coexistence and commercial dependency. The company could not ignore indigenous authority because its survival depended upon it. In that sense, corporate sovereignty was negotiated sovereignty. Indigenous nations retained practical control over land use and mobility. Company authority was strongest at fixed posts and weakest in open plains. Comparative imperial models highlight the uniqueness of Rupert's Land. The British East India Tea Company exercised far more direct territorial governance in parts of India, maintaining armies and collecting revenue. The Virginia Company in early 17th century America attempted plantation settlement with elected assemblies. In contrast, the Hudson's Bay Company pursued a low-density model. It did not encourage large-scale agricultural settlement for most of its history. Its personnel were limited. The economic objective was extraction through trade rather than territorial transformation. The American territorial model provides another point of comparison. As the United States expanded westward, Congress established territorial governments that anticipated eventual statehood under the equal footing doctrine. Though often imposed on indigenous lands through coercive treaties or military force, territorial governance involved civilian administration and legislative structures. In Rupert's Land, no such progression existed prior to 1870. There was no articulated pathway from company rule to representative government. The territory was an asset managed from afar. Over time, this model faced strain. The decline of the beaver trade, the rise of agricultural interest, and increasing settler presence in the Red River region exposed the limitations of corporate sovereignty. The Selkirk settlement, established in 1812, introduced a population whose political expectations differed from company employees. Conflicts between settlers and the Northwest Company culminated in violence at Seven Oaks in 1816. Although the Hudson's Bay Company eventually merged with its rival in 1821, consolidating monopoly control, it now governed a more complex society that included European settlers, Métis communities, and transient traders. In response, the company formalized aspects of governance. Courts were established at Red River. Magistrates were appointed. Ordinances addressed land tenure and local order. Yet these institutions remained under company oversight. There was no equivalent to the responsible government movements that reshaped British North American colonies in the mid-19th century. Rupert's Land remained under proprietary control long after political reform transformed other parts of British North America. By the 1850s and the 1860s, critics in Britain and Canada questioned whether corporate rule over such a vast territory was appropriate. Canadian expansionists viewed Rupert's Land as essential to national development, particularly in preventing American encroachment. They argued that railway construction and agricultural settlement required governmental authority rather than commercial monopoly. The company itself recognized declining profitability in fur trading and began negotiating compensation for surrendering territorial rights. The legal architecture of transfer reveals the peculiar nature of corporate sovereignty. Britain, not the company, held ultimate imperial authority. Yet it treated the company's charter as conferring proprietary rights requiring compensation. The 1868 Rupert's Land Act authorized transfer of the territory to Canada upon terms agreed with the company. The deed of surrender in 1869 formalized this arrangement, with Canada paying £300,000 and granting land rights to the company. This transition underscores the ambiguity of sovereignty in Rupert's Land. The company could not independently cede territory, only the Crown could authorize transfer. Yet the Crown compensated the company as though it possessed a property interest in sovereignty. Indigenous nations were not consulted in this negotiation, reflecting imperial legal assumptions that ultimate authority resided with Britain. In practice, however, sovereignty on the ground remained layered and contested. The long-term implications of corporate governance were significant. Because Rupert's Land was administered as proprietary territory rather than colony, it entered Canada not as a self-governing unit but as an acquired land. There was no entrenched representative institutions to negotiate terms of confederation. Unlike Ontario or Quebec, which had developed legislative assemblies and political leadership prior to 1867, the Prairie West lacked formal provincial status. Its incorporation into Canada therefore followed a path of territorial administration under federal authority. From a decentralization perspective, this origin matters. The Prairie provinces did not negotiate entry as equal partners. They were transferred assets. While the Manitoba Act of 1870 created a province, its initial size and jurisdiction were limited. The larger Northwest Territories remained under Ottawa's direct control. Control of public lands and natural resources stayed with the federal government until 1930. The legacy of corporate sovereignty thus shaped subsequent federal dominance. At the same time, it would be simplistic to characterize the Hudson's Bay Company solely as an instrument of oppression or centralization. For much of its existence, the company maintained a relatively light administrative footprint. It did not impose settler majorities or eradicate indigenous governance structures outright. Its trade networks integrated the region into global markets without immediate demographic displacement on the scale seen in parts of the United States. Stability along trade corridors benefited multiple parties, at least until ecological depletion and settler expansion altered the balance. Political psychology formed in this era also deserves attention. Corporate governance was distant and hierarchical, yet it was predictable. Company authority rested on contracts and trade relationships rather than mass taxation or regulatory bureaucracy. When Canadian federal authority later replaced company rule, the shift from commercial monopoly to centralized state administration altered the character of governance. The state's objectives, railways, settlement, uniform law, differed from the company's narrower commercial priorities. In comparative terms, Rupert's Land stands as an example of delegated sovereignty that delayed the development of local political institutions. Unlike American territories that transitioned to statehood or Australian colonies that federated with established governments, the Prairie West entered Confederation without entrenched self-governing frameworks. This structural difference would influence debates about autonomy, resource control, and representation in the decades that followed. Understanding the Hudson's Bay Company as a corporate sovereign clarifies that the Prairie West was neither stateless nor fully colonial in the conventional sense. It was governed through commercial authority layered atop indigenous sovereignty under ultimate imperial oversight. The transfer of this layered structure to Canada did not erase its complexity. It replaced one distant authority with another, setting the stage for the constitutional questions that would shape Alberta and Saskatchewan's political trajectory long after the fur trade faded from memory. By the late 1860s, the political future of Rupert's Land had become a matter of urgency for British and Canadian policymakers. The Hudson's Bay Company's monopoly was weakening, the fur trade was declining, and the newly formed Dominion of Canada was looking westward. Expansion was framed in Ottawa not only as economic opportunity but as geopolitically necessary. The United States had recently completed the Civil War, purchased Alaska from Russia in 1867, and continued to push settlement across the Great Plains. Canadian leaders feared that if they did not consolidate control over the Northwest, American influence, commercial or territorial, would move northward. Yet the legal pathway to expansion did not begin on the plains. It began in London. Under the British North America Act of 1867, Canada would not simply claim Rupert's Land. The territory remained under British imperial authority, administered through the Hudson's Bay Company's 1670 charter. To transfer it, Britain would need to legislate, and the company would need compensation for surrendering its proprietary rights. The resulting Rupert's Land Act of 1868 authorized the Crown to accept a surrender of the territory from the company and transfer it to Canada upon agreed terms. Negotiations unfolded between Canadian representatives, British officials, and company directors. Indigenous nations and the Métis population of Red River were not invited to participate. The discussion revolved around compensation, land rights, and timing. In 1869, the deed of surrender was finalized. Canada agreed to pay £300,000 and allow the company to retain certain land parcels around trading posts. On paper, sovereignty moved from a chartered corporation to the Dominion of Canada. From a legal standpoint in imperial doctrine, this was orderly. From the standpoint of those living in Red River, it was destabilizing. The Red River settlement was not an empty trading post, but a community of approximately 12,000 people, the majority of whom were Métis. They farmed narrow river lots in the French-Canadian style, hunted buffalo seasonally, and traded with the company. They possessed their own institutions, including parish councils and hunt regulations. When Canadian surveyors arrived in 1869 to impose a rectangular township grid system without consulting residents, many interpreted it as an assertion of control that disregarded their land tenure. The immediate spark for resistance came when the surveyors began measuring property lines across existing farms. The Métis understood land ownership through occupation and long-established custom. Canadian authorities operated under a system of formal title and cadastral mapping. The clash was administrative, but it quickly became political. In October 1869, a group led by Louis Riel halted survey operations. Riel, educated in Montreal and fluent in both French and English, emerged as a spokesperson for the community's grievances. He argued that no transfer of sovereignty could legitimately occur without the consent of the inhabitants. A provisional government was formed. Its aim was not immediate independence, but negotiation. A winter scene inside Upper Fort Garry captures the tension of that moment. Snow presses against the wooden walls as delegates gather round rough tables. Candles flicker in the cold air. Riel speaks calmly but firmly. The people of Red River must determine the terms of entry into Canada. Representatives debate language rights, land guarantees, and provincial status. Outside, uncertainty spreads. Some settlers fear lawlessness, others see opportunity for political recognition. The provisional government drafted a list of rights demanding, among other things, bilingual institutions, local control of public lands, and provincial status within Confederation. These demands were transmitted to Ottawa. For Prime Minister John A. Macdonald and his government, the uprising posed a challenge. They had negotiated transfer at the imperial level but had not secured local assent. The execution of Thomas Scott, an Ontario settler who opposed the provisional government, transformed the political climate. Scott's death hardened opinion in Ontario and complicated negotiations. Yet, despite outrage, Ottawa recognized that force alone would not resolve the issue without risk of wider instability. The Manitoba Act of 1870 represented a compromise. It created the province of Manitoba, granting it representation in Parliament and promising land allocations for Métis children. It guaranteed certain language and religious rights. On paper, it appeared to address the principal demands of the provisional government, yet the province's initial boundaries were small, a fraction of the larger Northwest, and control over public lands and natural resources remained with the federal government. This distinction is crucial. Manitoba entered Confederation as a province, but not on the same footing as Ontario or Quebec in terms of jurisdiction over lands and resources. The surrounding territory became the Northwest Territories under direct federal administration. The promise of local autonomy was limited and gradual. The question arises, was Rupert's Land annexed, negotiated into Confederation, or absorbed? From the perspective of imperial law, the process was negotiated and legitimate. Britain authorized transfer. Canada compensated the Hudson's Bay Company. Parliament enacted the Manitoba Act. A province was created with representation and defined rights. There was no formal declaration of conquest. From the perspective of Red River residents, however, the initial transfer occurred without consultation. Negotiation only followed resistance. Consent was reactive rather than foundational. The Manitoba Act, while addressing some concerns, did not fully implement the autonomy envisioned by the provisional government. The smaller provincial boundaries and federal control over lands limited practical self-government. For Indigenous nations beyond Red River, the process resembled absorption more than negotiation. The transfer assumed that Britain possessed sovereignty capable of conveyance. Yet Indigenous leaders had not ceded land through treaty at any time in many areas of the Northwest. The numbered treaties that would cover much of present-day Alberta and Saskatchewan were negotiated after Canada asserted jurisdiction, not before. In that sense, the transfer preceded treaty-making rather than emerging from it. Comparative examples help clarify the distinctiveness of this episode. In the United States, territorial expansion often followed a pattern. Acquisition through treaty or conquest, establishment of a territorial government, and eventual statehood under the Equal Footing Doctrine. While Indigenous nations were frequently coerced, the formal legal pathway anticipated equal state status. In Rupert's Land, by contrast, the pathway to provincial equality was uneven. Manitoba was created, but the larger prairie region remained under federal control. Alberta and Saskatchewan would not become provinces until 1905, and even then without resource control. In Australia, British colonies were established separately and later federated in 1901 through negotiations among self-governing entities. The Prairie West lacked pre-existing colonial legislatures capable of bargaining entry terms collectively. Corporate governance had left little institutional infrastructure for democratic negotiation. The annexation versus negotiation debate thus hinges on perspective and scale. At the imperial level, the transaction was negotiated between recognized authorities. At the local level, negotiation occurred only after resistance, and even then under asymmetrical power conditions. For the broader Indigenous population, sovereignty shifted without direct consent, to be followed by treaties that redefined land relations under Canadian law. Counterarguments deserve serious consideration. Canadian leaders contended that delay and expansion risked American encroachment. The completion of a transcontinental railway required national jurisdiction over Western lands. Without integration into Confederation, the Northwest might have fragmented into competing territories influenced by U.S. economic gravity. From this vantage point, swift incorporation served strategic stability. Moreover, the Manitoba Act did establish provincial institutions and representation in Parliament. It recognized linguistic and religious rights in ways that aligned with Confederation's broader compromises. Over time, Manitoba expanded its boundaries and acquired resource control in 1930 alongside Alberta and Saskatchewan. One could argue that initial constraints reflected transitional realities rather than permanent subordination. Yet, transitional structures often leave durable imprints. The Prairie West entered Confederation not through a founding negotiation among equals, but through transfer and subsequent adjustment. The political psychology of this origin differs from that of provinces that formed the original Union in 1867. Manitoba's early struggles, the displacement of many Métis families following 1870, and the delayed provincial status of the larger Northwest contributed to a sense that authority flowed from Ottawa outward rather than emerging from regional self-determination. The Red River resistance occupies a complex place in Canadian political memory. It is alternately framed as rebellion, resistance, or foundational negotiation. For the purposes of understanding prairie incorporation, its significance lies less in symbolic debate and more in structural outcome. It demonstrated that local populations could compel negotiation, but it also revealed the limits of that negotiation within the Imperial Confederation framework. The long-term implications extend beyond Manitoba. When Alberta and Saskatchewan were eventually created as provinces in 1905, the federal government retained control over Crown lands and natural resources. Only in 1930 were these transferred. That delayed equality echoed the earlier pattern established in 1870, provincial status granted but with constrained jurisdiction. Whether labeled annexation or negotiated entry, the transfer of Rupert's Land and the Red River Resistance marked the beginning of a federal relationship defined by asymmetry. Sovereignty moved from corporate charter to national state without a comprehensive regional convention to set terms. The Manitoba Act mitigated immediate crisis but did not fully resolve the structural imbalance embedded in the manner of incorporation. Understanding this moment is essential for later debates about autonomy and decentralization. It illustrates that the Prairie West's relationship with Confederation was shaped less by founding partnership and more by staged incorporation. That historical pathway influences how questions of power and sovereignty continue to be framed in Alberta and Saskatchewan today. When Rupert's Land was transferred to Canada in 1869-1870, the legal architecture that followed did not immediately place the Prairie West on equal constitutional footing with the provinces that formed Confederation in 1867. Instead, most of the region was organized as territory. That distinction, territory versus province, was not merely administrative. It carried profound legal and political implications that shaped the trajectory of Alberta and Saskatchewan for decades. Under the British North America Act of 1867, later renamed the Constitution Act 1867, provinces possessed constitutionally entrenched powers. Section 92 assigned them jurisdiction over property and civil rights, local matters, education, subject to denominational protections, and the management of public lands and natural resources. These powers were not delegated by Ottawa in an ordinary legislative sense. They were constitutionally guaranteed. Any alteration required constitutional amendment. Territories, by contrast, did not enjoy this entrenched status. Parliament possessed plenary authority to make laws for the peace, order, and good government of territories not yet admitted as provinces. In practical terms, this meant that Ottawa could determine the structure, powers, and limits of territorial governance. Legislative councils in the Northwest Territories were created and modified by federal statute. Their authority was contingent rather than constitutional. The Northwest Territories Act of 1875 gradually introduced elected representation and limited self-government, but the scope of authority remained subordinate to federal oversight. Most importantly, the federal government retained control over Crown lands and natural resources. Settlement policy, railway routing, and immigration were directed from Ottawa. Revenues from land sales flowed to the federal treasury rather than to territorial governments. This arrangement contrasted sharply with the status of Ontario and Quebec, which entered Confederation with established legislatures and control over their internal resources. Even Manitoba, created in 1870, initially lacked control over public lands, though it held provincial status in other respects. Alberta and Saskatchewan, when created in 1905, were granted provincial institutions but similarly denied control over natural resources, until the Natural Resources Transfer Agreements of 1930. The constitutional difference between province and territory was therefore not symbolic. It affected fiscal capacity, political leverage, and the development of regional institutions. Provinces could rely on resource revenues and property rights jurisdictions to shape economic development. Territories operated under fiscal dependence, reliant on federal appropriations, and constrained in policy scope. A comparison with the United States illuminates this structural divergence. The American Constitution, though silent in explicit detail about territorial progression, established a practice under the Northwest Ordinance and subsequent legislation that new states would be admitted on an equal footing with the original states. While Congress governed territories prior to statehood, the expectation was that territorial status was transitional. Once admitted, states received full constitutional equality including control over public lands within their borders subject to certain federal reservations. The equal footing doctrine became an entrenched principle in American jurisprudence. When new states entered the Union, whether Ohio in 1803 or later Western states, they did so as co-equal sovereigns within the federal system. Although the federal government retained certain lands, the political symbolism of equality was explicit. Territorial administration was framed as preparation for statehood rather than indefinite subordination. Canada's model did not adopt a comparable doctrine. The Prairie Provinces entered Confederation through federal legislation rather than through a negotiated constitutional amendment process involving equal original status. Alberta and Saskatchewan's enabling statutes were ordinary acts of Parliament. While constitutionally valid, this pathway underscored their origin as creations of federal authority rather than founding partners. Defenders of the Canadian approach argue that such centralization was necessary. In the 1870s and 1880s, the Prairie West was sparsely populated by settlers. Large-scale infrastructure projects, notably the Canadian Pacific Railway, required coordinated national investment. Federal control of lands allowed Ottawa to use land grants to finance railway construction and encourage immigration. A decentralized model might have fragmented authority and slowed development. Moreover, territorial governance provided administrative flexibility. As population grew, elected institutions expanded. When Alberta and Saskatchewan were created in 1905, they received representation in Parliament and full participation in Confederation. The subsequent transfer of national resources in 1930 corrected earlier imbalances. From this perspective, territorial status was a transitional phase rather than structural inequity. Yet, transitional phases can leave durable legacies. For nearly a quarter century after 1905, Alberta and Saskatchewan lacked control over their most significant economic assets. Resource revenues that might have funded provincial institutions instead accrued to the federal government. This delayed fiscal autonomy shaped political culture. Provincial leaders argued that equality within Confederation required control over resources, comparable to that enjoyed by Ontario and Quebec. The political psychology of delayed equality is significant. Regions that perceive themselves as entering a federation without full parity may develop heightened sensitivity to federal encroachment. Even after formal equality is achieved, historical memory can frame federal authority as supervisory rather than collaborative. In Alberta's case, later disputes over energy regulation and equalization payments were often interpreted through this lens of initial asymmetry. Comparative federal systems offer additional context. In Australia, colonies federated in 1901 as self-governing entities that retained significant powers. While the Commonwealth government gradually expanded fiscal authority, the original states entered the federation with established legislatures and control over internal affairs. In Germany, Länder possessed constitutionally entrenched powers and representation through the Bundesrat, where state governments participate directly in federal legislation affecting their interests. Neither system originated from corporate territorial transfer in the manner of Rupert's Land. Canada's prairie model thus stands as distinctive. A vast territory administered centrally, gradually transformed into provinces through federal statute, with resource control delayed. The absence of an explicit equal footing doctrine meant that equality evolved over time rather than being embedded at the moment of admission. Long-term consequences of this structure extend beyond fiscal matters. Control over land influences settlement patterns, infrastructure investment, and economic diversification. Federal management of prairie lands during early development shaped railway corridors, immigration policy, and agricultural homesteading. Provincial governments inherited economies structured by decisions made elsewhere. The legal distinction between territory and province also influenced political identity. Territorial governance fostered a perception that Ottawa directed Western development. Provincial creation in 1905 marked a milestone, but the retention of resource control reinforced the sense that authority remained centralized. When resource jurisdiction was finally transferred in 1930, it was celebrated not merely as administrative reform, but as a restoration of parity. It would be overstated to claim that territorial status alone determined later alienation. Economic cycles, global commodity markets, and national political alignments played substantial roles. Yet constitutional origins matter. The Prairie Provinces did not join Confederation as equal founders. They were incorporated through stages of federal oversight. The legal framework chosen in 1870 and 1905 reflected pragmatic considerations of the era, but it also embedded a narrative of delayed autonomy. In evaluating contemporary debates about decentralization or sovereignty, the territorial province distinction serves as foundational context. It demonstrates that the relationship between the Prairie West and Ottawa was shaped by central administration before it became one of provincial equality. The absence of an equal footing doctrine comparable to that of the United States meant that equality had to be negotiated incrementally. Whether that incremental approach was prudent statecraft or structural imbalance remains open to interpretation. What is clear is that the legal pathway of incorporation influenced fiscal capacity, political psychology, and institutional development. The Prairie West entered Canada not as a ready-made province, but as a territory to be governed, settled, and gradually empowered. That origin continues to inform how power, sovereignty, and federal balance are debated more than a century later. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.